It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Today I spoke to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the recently announced Climate Action Blueprint, the accessibility of electric vehicles, and flaws within our immigration system. Let's start off by talking about the recently announced Climate Change Commission Blueprint. As Climate Change Minister, what was your involvement with this process?
The Climate Change Commission are politically independent, so they developed the report entirely under their own steam with no direct engagement from me. Of course, my involvement was that I started this in the sense that in the last term of government we passed the Zero Carbon Act, which put in place both our long-term climate change targets but also set up the Climate Change Commission and established the rules around which it can operate.
The key word with this blueprint is achievability. Could you elaborate on what makes these suggestions achievable?
So they've done a number of things. They've done what you would call a bottom-up analysis from each sector. So they've kind of looked at, for example, with transport, which is our fastest growing area of emissions, they've said, what do we think we've actually got the technology and the economic capability of doing within the 15 years of these first three emissions budget periods? And so they've looked at things like our ability to electrify public transport, to increase public transport, to invest in walking and cycling infrastructure, and to organise our main cities like Auckland so that people don't need to drive as much. They've looked at the what they think is a doable rate of EV uptake, and how fast we can start to produce biofuels to mix into our regular petrol. And they've said, okay, you know, based on the best evidence available, this is what we think can happen over the course of the coming 15 years. And then they've sort of applied an economic analysis to the whole thing to say, well, you know, what are the likely costs and benefits of that? And so the reason why they've done that is that, you know, I think there are a lot of countries in the world that have set these very ambitious targets but don't really have a terribly good plan to achieve them. And New Zealand in the past has set targets without a particular plan to achieve them either.
We've also got some solid insight into the costs of inaction versus action. Could you tell me about the findings there?
Yeah, look, this is something I was really pleased about because this has been missing from virtually every economic analysis that's ever been done around climate change. Usually what happens is people do something called computerized general equilibrium modeling, which, you know, economic students will be familiar with, but is pretty arcane to most of the rest of us. And they say, well, okay, if the country, you know, put in place all these policies and did this to try and reduce emissions, what would that look like in terms of drag on GDP growth versus business as usual? And so because there is some drag, generally in the past people have gone, oh, it's going to cost the country too much money, let's not do anything. What the Commission have done is they've also provided a counterfactual. They've said, okay, so, you know, here we think that the drag over the next 15 years is about 0.5% of GDP by the time you get to the year 2035. What would that look like if you delayed action? And actually what they've found is that the cost of inaction is about twice the cost of action.
So let's get into the Commission's actual advice. I'm going to split these up into economic implications and infrastructural implications because otherwise there's going to be way too much to go over. But let's start off by talking about the economic impacts on things like finance and agriculture. What sort of recommendations were made in regards to the emissions trading scheme and the impact that climate action will have on our economy as a whole?
Well, so they've done a few things when it comes to finance. You know, the emissions trading scheme is one of our most important tools, and it's really the only tool that applies across most of the economy. And what they've said is that the two of the settings that are contained in the emissions trading scheme at the moment are a floor price below which we have said we will not sell units into the system. So it's like saying we guarantee that there'll be a minimum price. And currently that's set at $20, and the Commission have recommended that we immediately increase that to $30 and then increase it every year by a set amount. And at the top end, there's also what's called a cost containment reserve, which I know is not exactly transparent language, but basically what it means is if the price spikes, we have the ability to issue more units into the system, which will help to kind of cool the price, and that sort of just prevents you from having economic shocks in the short term. And currently that's set at $50, and they've recommended that we immediately increase that to $70 and then also increase it by a set amount every year. So what they're saying is effectively they're signalling that they think that the price of carbon is too constrained and that the ETS should be allowed to do more of the heavy lifting in terms of sending that price signal about the cost of pollution. And then they've also made a number of other recommendations, particularly in terms of how the government organises its finances. And actually, Grant Robertson signalled this on Budget Day at the beginning of May when he talked about how the way that the Public Finance Act works is it sort of has some useful short-term disciplines for government, but it's very bad at recognising kind of intergenerational, complex, distributed challenges like climate change. And so, again, that's one of the reasons why, you know, governments in the past haven't significantly invested in climate change solutions, because we haven't, you know, the nature of the budgeting process doesn't really allow for it.
As for infrastructure like transport, energy and construction, what recommendations were made in order to make these areas greener?
Essentially what they've said is that we need to stop building new infrastructure that increases emissions, and that we need to basically plan to, you know, when our existing infrastructure gets to the end of its technical and or economic life, that we need to replace it with infrastructure that helps to lock in a low emissions pathway. And that would be described as the kind of least regrets option. The exception to this is areas where, you know, particularly in relation to energy, we've got some infrastructure assets like coal boilers for heating and for power that we need to decommission before they get to the end of their economic life and to replace with clean alternatives.
On the topic of transport, I understand that a new rebate scheme has been announced for electric vehicles. Even so, how do we make these vehicles affordable and accessible to those with lower incomes?
So there's a few different strategies here, one of which is that the Feebate scheme that we announced yesterday applies to vehicles that are newly imported into New Zealand, whether they are new cars or used cars. But it doesn't apply to the second-hand market for vehicles that are already in New Zealand. And so the idea there is that, you know, because the vast majority of New Zealanders actually buy their cars in the second-hand market, if we're making it cheaper for the first buyers of these imports, and mostly those are either quite wealthy people or comparatively wealthy people or their company car fleets, those then move into the second-hand market within sort of 3 to 5 years. And so what you'll see is that we're, you know, kind of you and most of your listeners buy your cars in the second-hand market, they will be cheaper when they get to the second-hand market because they were cheaper to buy the first time round. The second thing is that we're actively exploring other options. So one of the things, I mean, it's actually already cheaper to operate an electric vehicle by some margin. So, you know, you can essentially recharge your electric car for the equivalent of about 25 to 40 cents a litre of petrol. And of course, petrol is considerably more expensive than that. So the problem is, of course, the upfront cost of the vehicle is prohibitively expensive for most retail customers. And so one of the options that we and, in fact, a number of private sector players are looking at is a leasing scheme. So you don't actually pay the upfront cost of the vehicle, and then you recover that through the operating cost, because of course that's so much lower.
A common issue that I hear with electric vehicles is that while charging is affordable, there's a sort of a lack of accessibility in terms of the number of charging stations and their infrequency, especially in the more rural parts of New Zealand. Is there a plan to sort of address that issue?
Yes, there is. And again, that was one of the recommendations that the Climate Change Commission made, was that we need to have essentially a state highway network that's got considerably more EV charging capacity than the current one. So you can pretty much drive anywhere in the country and there will be a charger, but the problem is you might end up queuing to use it because there aren't enough actual charges at the station where you get to. So that definitely needs to be resolved. I think the vast majority of trips that are taken by people are actually within cities rather than on highways. And for that, most people will end up with a charger at home because the vast majority of houses in New Zealand either have off-street parking or a garage or something like that. That won't fix everything, but that'll go quite some way to resolving that issue. And then instead of charging on the street or charging in town, people will simply plug in at night when they get home and it'll be full again in the morning when it's time to go.
So next, let's talk about this open letter to the Immigration Minister, which you guys plan to deliver very soon, I understand. When is this happening?
I understand it's happening in the next week or so. I don't think we've actually set a date for it to hand over. We're asking for members of the public to support it, and it does seem to be quite widely supported at the moment.
Could you elaborate on why the Green Party is opposed to the current immigration system?
Well, the issue that we've got, particularly at the moment, has been exacerbated, obviously, extremely by COVID, is that you've got a lot of people who have been separated from their families for very long periods of time, and the current settings don't assist with that. There are also significant gaps in the labour market. You know, you read stories every week about different employers in different parts of the country who are struggling to fill demand. And so one of the things that we're saying in this letter is that those kinds of work visas shouldn't be tied to a single employer. So if you do get a temporary work visa and you're over here, you should be able to move to another employer where there's a real need for your skills and talents.
As you've mentioned in the most recent press release about this, the government is planning a reset of our immigration system. What are your hopes and concerns for these changes?
I guess broadly speaking, you know, we've got a lot of kind of quite detailed recommendations for the minister and for the government around this, but I think if you just kind of step back a bit, Our sense in the Greens is that our immigration policy for some decades now, this isn't a function of the current government alone, it's sort of something that's built up over a long time, is that we treat immigration and immigrants essentially through an economic lens, and we would like to take a sort of a more humanitarian approach and to say, well, you know, kind of what are the outcomes that we're looking for socially, recognising obviously that, you know, there is an economic component to it, but I think we tend to treat immigrants like economic units rather than as people, I guess, with families and heritages and cultures that need to be maintained in order for them to be able to successfully integrate into society.
So I wanted to ask you for your thoughts on the categorisation of migrants as skilled or low-skilled. What do you think of these categories?
We have had a significant problem in New Zealand that was exacerbated a great deal under the last national government, where because that government really wanted to drive a kind of low-wage economic growth, they really relied heavily on what we call low-skilled immigrant labour. And, of course, that also leads to some really quite horrendous stories of migrant exploitation, where people were brought in on extremely low wages, tied to single employers, which makes them vulnerable to further exploitation, but often, you know, didn't have, for example, terribly good English skills, weren't able to access union support very easily, and so on. And so, you know, we kind of, I think, had that completely wrong as a country. What the current government's intention is, they're trying to sort of resolve that problem and still say, okay, well, we obviously need immigration for economic purposes is the line that they've taken, but they want to focus more on what they describe as highly skilled. And I think that there are all sorts of issues that arise, like I said, from treating people as if they're kind of economic units only.
Lastly, let's just briefly touch on the nurses' strike, which took place on Wednesday. Negotiations are due to resume next week. Do you have any hopes or expectations for this next round of negotiations?
Well, broadly speaking, I hope that as a country we're able to find it within ourselves to pay nurses a decent wage. I mean, you know, I think COVID in particular put huge amounts of pressure on our health system and our frontline healthcare workers, nurses in particular. It's never been the best paid profession in the country, and yet it is an absolutely essential service. And so, you know, I just hope we're able to get to a resolution where nurses are paid what they're worth, and that we're able to attract more people into the profession, and to start to alleviate some of the huge pressures that they are under.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.